I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. An outbreak of measles that started in California has spread to four other states now and Mexico. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, measles is one of the most infectious diseases, and infants are especially at risk. Orange County, California, a hotbed of the anti-immunization movement, has been hardest hit by the outbreak, raising concerns about parents who chose not to vaccinate their children. It's time again for Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr, internist at Sinai Hospital, expert in infectious disease, and our doctor in residence. We'll look at that story and others, including the apparent containment of Ebola in West Africa and at Ebola's hidden costs. All that ahead on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Sorry about that little noise. Dan Rodericks here. Welcome back to Midday. I said that, didn't I? It's another edition of Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr in this hour of our show. Thanks for making Midday part of your day, everybody. Dr. John Smarr in our studio with us. Nice to see you again, John.
Wonderful to be here in the land of culture, apparently.
Yeah, I like that. That's something new. I'm glad to hear it. We have a lot to talk about this hour. Dr. John Smarr, Midday's doctor in residence, we call him. He's assistant director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital. That's his specialty, infectious diseases. He's also a program director of Sinai's internal medicine residency program and joins us once a month to talk about, well, sometimes we focus on just one topic, and this hour we're going to look at several topics. Later on in the show, we'll get an update on the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. All three of the hardest hit countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, are experiencing declines in new cases. And a UN mission chief said this week that the tide seems to have turned there for the better. However, there is some fallout from the epidemic that we'll talk about, having to do with hunger and the availability of food. In Sierra Leone alone, an estimated 120,000 people have become food insecure because of the outbreak and its ramifications. So, John, we have some other things, several other stories to talk about. We're going to start with this measles story out of California, an outbreak of measles. Measles that was contained in the United States by the year 2000, I think. That's what I read. And we have an outbreak now in California associated with Disneyland, people who visited that theme park between December 17th and December 20th, so before Christmas. And now we're seeing, now I think the latest report is 70 confirmed cases and spreading beyond California to three other states and now Mexico as well. So,
yeah, this is pretty amazing.
Is it to you?
Is it?
I mean,
well, it's. I guess you could qualify the word that I'm using, because I'm not surprised, given, and we've talked about it before on this program, but just in terms of what we, especially as general public, physicians in general, infectious diseases folks like myself know about how the anti-vaccine movement has been a part of our sort of the national dialogue and culture, to use that word again, over the last few decades. And having concerns about, well, if there are pockets of folks who aren't getting vaccinated, all it takes is one person with an infection, potentially, to come in and start an outbreak. And so it still is amazing, because we're at an era where this shouldn't happen. As you had mentioned before, the CDC, their official statistic is that we eliminated measles from the United States in the year 2000. And what they mean by that is they don't mean that there weren't any cases. They mean that there was no longer, if you looked at it over a 12-month period, that there were spread of measles in the U.S. And so that was a big important piece of success with public health, with vaccines, and with things like that. And then now we've seen and we've heard of over the more recent years different outbreaks in different areas. But this one seems to be pretty significant, and it certainly seems to be one of the bigger ones that's been happening of late, and especially in terms of impacting the United States.
This area of California, we mentioned Orange County, has been described as a hotbed of the anti-vaccination movement in the United States. We talked about it on previous shows here. In fact, we presented a whole hour on this topic three or four years ago, looking at how this concern started. It started with an article published in Lancet, was later completely disavowed by Lancet, a big mistake they made in publishing this original piece, making this association between vaccination and autism. Remember that?
Right.
And then that led to this movement. I would describe it as something of a movement, an anti-vaccination movement, and we've seen it in Europe as well. Anyway, this measles outbreak in California this week, the state officials out there warned that children under 12 and anyone not vaccinated or otherwise immune to avoid the Disney parks. Disney Resort employees who had contact with measles-stricken coworkers were asked to stay home unless they can show they've been vaccinated or prove through a blood test that they're immune. That was a little surprise to read that. You can prove in a blood test that you're immune to measles.
Yeah, and actually that's a routine thing for anybody who is a healthcare worker. And so there's kind of an analogy here in terms of people coming into a space where they're interacting with a certain group of people. So here it's people going to Disneyland, for instance, and they're interacting with the employees in this sort of closed environment, and you have a lot of kids. The general analogy is with the healthcare system, you expect to go to see your doctor, and you expect to go to the hospital, and you don't expect there to be a potentially increased risk of going there, of getting certain diseases. Now, of course, being in a hospital, there are many hospital-acquired infections and big reasons that it's good not to be in the hospital. But I'm not really talking about those. I'm talking about things like that are vaccine-preventable. We're trying to do as little of harm as possible. And so I think it's probably worthwhile to step back and very quickly remind folks what measles is, because that's another big piece of it, is that there are younger generations who haven't really seen it or may have never seen it before and don't know what it is. And so whenever you don't see a thing and you don't have personal experience, or you only hear things through the media, then you don't have sort of the biggest recognition internally. And so what measles is, it's a virus. It is actually, many times it's quoted, and in fact, people were talking about it recently in context of Ebola, in terms of how easy it is to transmit Ebola. Measles is probably the most contagious of all the big viral pathogens or other pathogens that can affect human beings. In terms of epidemiologists can do math to figure out, well, if you have one case of somebody who gets measles, how many more people are going to get it? And they could, there's a standard way that they do this. They can apply it to Ebola, they can apply it to HIV, they can apply it to all sorts of things. And so the estimate for this thing that's called the R0, that is essentially saying that all things being equal, if one person gets the measles, 18 other people are going to get it as a result. And there are other ways that you can look at this. But the bottom line is it's a virus, it's transmitted via the respiratory route, so coughing, sneezing, and then...
Would you say highly contagious? Given
I would say highly highly contagious, absolutely. Yeah. And so that's something
I think
that,
that's the term that CDC uses.
Right.
Yeah.
And so back before we were vaccinating for this disease, it was, the stats were in the U.S., something like 3 to 4 million people were getting measles, and something like 500 to 600 of those people were dying. And it's something that predominantly affects children, but certainly can affect adults. And what happens is you sort of have respiratory symptoms, you can have fever, you can have cough after a few days. And this is sort of the characteristic measles thing. You get a very particular looking rash. And in fact, you can get a rash on the inside of your mouth, on the back of your palate. And in many folks, and there's no real treatment for it. So once you get it, you just pretty much have to support that person and hopefully they will get better. And it turns out that most people with the measles, they'll feel really sick, but they will get better. But the problems are that there are complications like pneumonia, diarrhea, encephalitis, so inflammation of the brain, and some of those consequences can lead you to die, especially if you have medical problems or very young children.
Is the vaccine effective at any age?
The vaccine is, and so that it gets into sort of the talk about this other piece where you're saying, how do you prove whether or not the vaccine is still effective or if somebody's immune? So as we all know, there's a series of vaccines that we have when we're children. And for the most part, what happens is we pretty much say, okay, then you're good to go, because there are only certain types of studies that have been done to see, whether or not the vaccines work. And the whole point of vaccinating children is that since they usually are the biggest sort of frontline population in the outbreak, it's if we can get them set, then that's going to go a lot towards controlling measles and the rest of the population. Now, of course, how vaccines work is you give them and they're supposed to stimulate your immune system to make antibodies, which are going to hang around in you for the rest of your life and protect you if you're ever exposed to it again. So there are blood tests that you can do, and anyone who's a healthcare worker like myself, when I started as a medical student and then when I came to Sinai Hospital for my residency, they do a blood test because they want to prove either what are the dates that you had your vaccine, or we can actually check to see if you still have those antibodies in your system. And this is an important thing because, again, nothing in medicine is easy. Nothing in life is easy or straightforward.
Right.
People would like to believe that you get a vaccine, and it's going to work. And it's going to work 100% of the time. And that's actually
for the rest of your life.
For the rest of your life. And that's actually not true. And in many people, they may get the vaccine, and there may be a reason in some people where they don't really mount a good immune response. They don't respond to the vaccine the way that they're supposed to. In other people, depending on a number of factors, it may be that as they go through life, the immunity, which is supposed to, in theory, stay with your entire life, wanes off. And so your immune system just sort of forgets that it ever encountered this in the past. So if you were exposed to the infection, you could have this as a problem again. And so when you see the reporting on this, what you'll see is that they do, and I think appropriately, focus on the folks that haven't been vaccinated. But you also see that that's not everybody. And this is another thing that's a little confusing for some people to figure out that, okay, well, if these other people are vaccinated, why did they get it? And the answer is like I said, some people respond to the vaccine differently, and there may have been reasons why someone who is vaccinated may have, when confronted with being actively exposed to the big infection, their immune system just was not able to mount enough of a response. And so vaccines are not a yes-no thing. It works in a lot of cases, but not necessarily in all.
But the reason we eliminated measles by the year 2000, according to the CDC, is because of all the immunization.
Correct, yes.
The vaccination. Right. So it was effective, one can say, for most of the population that mm-hmm. received it, right?
Right, and it's one of these things where measles, it's predominantly is in humans. This isn't, we're not talking about, there are some things like influenza or other strains of different infections that can persist in a bunch of other animal populations. This is something that we should be able to completely get rid of.
Your specialty is infectious diseases. Is there any reason not to vaccinate a child, in your opinion?
In general, absolutely not. You should always consider that. When you're getting into issues of there are sometimes circumstances surrounding health issues with the child where it might be unsafe to give them the vaccine, then that could potentially be a problem. And there's a whole list of
those. But for generally a healthy child.
But generally, absolutely not. There's no reason for someone who's healthy not to get the vaccines. And this plays into a little bit of the anti-vaccinationist, if you want to use it, that discussion. And so because what it is essentially questioning, do the vaccines actually work? And we have excellent data, and we've got historically the track record of how well it worked. And then simultaneously, what are the risks of getting the vaccine? Now, why, when you get the vaccine, what is the chance that you will actually, because of the vaccine, have a problem? And these vaccines have felt to be very safe. The reactions that people can have to it that are common are very, very minimal. And the severe ones are very, very rare.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here. We have open phone lines during this hour of Midday on Health with Dr. John Smarr. Before we go to our first break in the hour, John, I want to touch on one other story, and that is Ebola. So some good news here. New cases on the decline each week, according to the UN and the World Health Organization. Sierra Leone still reporting the most number of new cases, but their numbers are down, too. We had a news report about schools reopening in Guinea, kids going back to school. So how does it look to you? I want to talk about the one story that I think it was The Atlantic had this week that's kind of troubling. But generally speaking, in terms of the outbreak, this is good news.
I mean, overall, we're at a spot of good news. And so and it's interesting because when you have a lack of people talking about a thing, then that means that it's less on people's minds and felt to be less important. And so overall, yes, good news. And then the natural question that people would ask is, all right, where do we go from here? We had our cases in the United States. We haven't had anything at all recently. What do we do with preparation? Did we already do a good job? Did we actually do things mm-hmm. to fix this, to prevent this from being a further problem? And I think my answer to that is yes, I think, because it's such a complex group of factors to look at. But from everything from the travel controls that they put down, again, we talked about that previously with the debates of do you quarantine people, do you limit their travel? I think ultimately we came up with a good, sensible option with regards to saying everybody, all the traffic from those countries going through five different airports. You can actually even go on the CDC's website and you can see that there is a kit that they're giving everyone who's coming back. If they are screened and have a potential risk factor for Ebola, they get information, they get a thermometer.
Right.
And so they have to report sort of on a regular basis every mm-hmm. day to the health department what their temperatures are and how are they doing.
There are also new protocols for mm-hmm. hospitals and emergency rooms. And I think in each state there is discussion, at least been discussion, about designating hospitals to receive patients suspected of Ebola.
Right, absolutely. And that's been the case. But this is leading into a very interesting question. Like, for instance, in Sinai, we're actually still having Ebola meetings. Hmm. Not because anyone has a huge, huge, huge concern based on the current outbreak, but simultaneously, the bigger thing is, where do we go from here? Because once this outbreak goes away, the challenging thing is going to figure out, how do we have a certain level of preparedness? How much of our readiness do we need to maintain? And because all of this costs time, it costs money. And so when there isn't a major problem, then people are naturally going to start questioning, what are we doing here? And so that's a complex question that we still have to figure out.
One of the consequences of the outbreak in West Africa that killed so many people and affected so many families was that children weren't able to go to school for, what, a good part of the year, I think, if kids are just returning to school now. But also, you know, the infrastructure of these countries, as particularly its food supply. That's why I was interested in this story in The Atlantic, I guess just in the last few days, a piece about people becoming food insecure, particularly in Sierra Leone. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, and the World Food Program estimated that 120,000 people in Sierra Leone have become food insecure as a result of Ebola, meaning they neither have the food they need nor are they able to buy it. By March, the report that came out this week predicts that the number will rise to 280,000. In other words, this is, I'm quoting The Atlantic here, the number of people in Sierra Leone who have died from Ebola, just over 3,000 to date, will be only a fraction of the number who will go hungry from it.
Mm-hmm.
So another consequence of that outbreak. Anyway, we have to take our first break, but we can talk about, go back to the measles story, the vaccines, if you want to talk about that. Also, an aspect of Ebola we should talk about with John a little bit is the push for a vaccine. 410-662-8780, the role of bad luck in developing cancer. We're going to talk about that during this hour of Midday on Health as well. You're welcome to give us a call with your questions for Dr. John Smarr. Welcome back to Midday. It's Midday on Health in this hour with Dr. John Smarr. And I saw a story about the co-discoverer of the Ebola virus saying, yeah, we've done a pretty good job, just as you say, pretty mm-hmm. good job, I think, but we need to push for a vaccine. We need to push hard for a vaccine.
Right. And so there was another quote I saw recently. So there are two vaccine candidates that are currently being tested in humans. And there's something like a list of 8 to 10 that other companies and collaborators are currently working to develop. Those two that are currently being tested, we've actually had for something like 10 years, essentially with back in the early aughts, 2000s up to 2003, they were sort of tested. They proved that they worked in monkeys and then they sat on the shelf for 10 years. And so someone was making a point in a scientific article I was reading that, okay, maybe it's going to cost something like $6 billion to bring this to market ultimately. But had we actually done it 10 years ago, then think of all of what we would have saved for that.
Right.
But the bottom
line... during this crisis?
Yes, in terms of hopefully sparing the crisis. So the bottom line is that we actually have two things that are actively being tested in people. And the thing that's been in the news recently is that the phase two trial for one of those is actually about to start next month. And that means they're testing it for figuring out what is the right dose, is it safe, those types of things. So those trials are ongoing this year.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday. Open phone lines for Midday on Health and Dr. John Smart. Jean in Timonium. Let's take Jean's call. Thanks for holding, Jean. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks, Dan. I'm calling because when I was in my early 30s and thinking about getting pregnant, my obstetrician said, did I ever have the measles? And I said, well, I know I had German measles. What else is there? Turns out, when they tested, I had not had rubella. And if a woman is pregnant and has not been vaccinated and becomes exposed to someone who has that, it might be a mild effect for the woman, but it can have very severe consequences for the baby that you're carrying. And I just wanted to emphasize that that's another reason why people should be sure that their children are vaccinated.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up. I know we're marching through these things pretty quickly, but I would upgrade your level of description to devastating. That the effect that can have on baby, if a mother gets a congenital measles or rubella infection, being two separate diseases, rubella and measles.
Hilda is calling from Frederick with a question about rubella. Hilda, go right ahead. You're on with Dr. Smar.
I have a 52-and-a-half-year-old adopted son whose mother had rubella in her seventh month, and he has a terrible problem. He works, he can do things almost better than I can do, some of them, but the brain, I don't know what it does. It suddenly snaps, it seems like to me. I mean, he married, he took care of a wife, saved money, but every now and then, I've lived with him for 50 years, and we still don't understand it. Things
you,
he can do.
You think
perfectly.
You think those things are related, Hilda? I guess, John. I think that's what she's suggesting.
Right, and so it certainly is the case. And it actually harkens back to what Jean had just called in about, is that if the mother, while carrying him, had a rubella infection while she was while he was in utero, while the baby was still inside her, then it's certainly possible that some of that might have been a congenital thing that has affected him even to this point.
Harry in Severna Park. Hilda, thanks for your call. Harry, go right ahead with your question, please.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I'm of the generation that was pre-vaccine, and in my youth, I had the measles, the rubella, the mumps. Is my immunity any stronger or the same as, say, who had the vaccine?
Thanks, Harry. That's an excellent question, and the answer to that is that, in theory, if you've had that, then your body it had both of those infections, the mumps and the measles, then your body should have made an immune response to those, which should protect you in the future. But going back to what we were talking about earlier, the way to prove that, if that circumstance needed to be proved, would be to go ahead and do this blood test to see, do you still have the antibodies there to protect you?
John, do you know when they developed the vaccine, when it was generally used?
It was 1963. Was either the last year. Well, I think it was about the time. It was 1963.
Man, I just missed that then.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking of
year.
Oh, I had a terrible year. I had measles, mumps, chickenpox all in a row. I went back and I saw my report card from school that year. I missed 42 days of school.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's amazing I'm here today, isn't
it? It's amazing.
But that was pre-63. So
measles was 63 was the year. Yeah.
Good question. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Jay, with another question for Dr. Smar about this. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to find out from Dr. Smar questions on measles and influenza. What percent of the current crop of measles cases have actually been vaccinated?
That's an excellent question, and I will say that it's a little bit hard to say because it depends on the different outbreaks, because we're looking at these different relatively tiny outbreaks.
We only have one, right?
Right, but right now, I mean historically over the last few years. So for instance, looking at this particular one, I believe, now I haven't looked to see what the current 70 was, but when I saw an article about this several days ago, the majority were in folks who had not been vaccinated, but I can't remember a specific percentage.
Okay.
Also, an influenza. I have not had my influenza shot this year. Should I get it at this point, or is it better just to wait till next year to get my flu shot because of the problem with the vaccine as far as covering what's going around?
Right, absolutely. And I think that what I would say is I would say just go ahead and get it. Now, there are people who would make a case for saying, okay, maybe flu season is peaking. We know that in terms of being well matched to what's floating around out there, the vaccine doesn't necessarily match up this year as well as we would have liked to the different circulating strains. But my opinion is that any protection that you can get, even if it's a little bit, that's still worthwhile to do.
And Steve in Baltimore with a question for Dr. Smar. Go right ahead.
Good afternoon. I have heard a health professional opine that receiving all these new vaccines, there's many, many new vaccines that are recommended, that there's some research that states that that by receiving all these vaccinations, that it actually reduces the body's ability to fight infection on its own. It doesn't have any more natural ability to fight infection. It's totally dependent on these vaccines. Is that true, or is there anything to support that?
Well, thank you for your question, Steve, and what I'm going to do is opine in the contrary, which is that there's this idea that in some people in certain pediatric circles refer it to as the too many, too soon hypothesis, that somehow by giving a bunch of vaccines, especially to a younger child, you're somehow overwhelming your body's ability to respond to those, and that would somehow be a problem. In terms of actual evidence for that, there is no credible evidence that that's a real thing. And in fact, when we are going around, especially as young children, constantly every day, we are exposed to so many different pathogens that our immune system is dealing with. We have billions of bacteria and viruses that live in our gut. And we know a lot about the microbiome in terms of the good gut bacteria, but the thing that we've been recognizing more and more is we have a huge amount of viruses that actually live inside of us, and the system is so complex. So getting the amount of vaccines that we do in terms of overwhelming the immune system, it's absolutely nothing to going through daily life, especially as a child, in terms of encountering different microbiological things in the environment that your immune system responds to.
Interesting, John. Here's a question by email from Dennis in the Otterbein neighborhood in Baltimore. He says, more than 20 years ago, I had a mild case of Guillain-Barré. Since then, I've been told not to get a flu vaccine. Since I'm approaching 70 and have a few underlying health issues, I'd be interested in your take on not getting a flu shot.
That is I constantly default to saying that these are interesting questions, because they are, because people, there's very smart questions to ask. This is a very interesting question, and it's hard to answer, because it does seem to be the case that in the past, especially with certain years or batches of the flu vaccine decades ago, that there was an increased risk of having Guillain-Barré, which is a progressive disorder for those who don't know where it is, where essentially you start getting muscular weakness and paralysis that starts at your legs, it goes all the way up, and in the worst cases, it can actually affect your lungs so that you end up on a ventilator. And sometimes folks recover, and unfortunately, sometimes folks die from this. So this is obviously a very terrifying, very serious condition. And so there's been a general blanket statement that if someone has had Guillain-Barré before, because the thought is that it may be that certain types of infections may trigger this, and there has been an association in the past with certain specific years or batches of a vaccine. And so one of the theories, for instance, the one year this occurred, was whether or not there was a bacteria that contaminated the vaccine that somehow triggered it. We still don't know for 100% sure or understand it. But in general, listed under the contraindications you shouldn't get it is if you've had Guillain-Barré in the past, the concern is, are you susceptible to getting it again? And so therefore, you should avoid the flu vaccine. And so it's hard for me to argue that you should get it, but you certainly are, in terms of if you have age, if you have other medical risk factors, then it's obviously something to consider. And I think that probably the best thing to do is not get it at this point, but continue to have discussions with your physicians and do all the best things that you can do with regards to hand hygiene and all the other sensible things to protect yourself from an infection.
You're listening to Midday on Health. Dan Rodrigues here with Dr. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital. We have three stories I just want to touch on briefly so we can get to the one that I think will take more time. Random chances or bad luck's role in developing cancer. A study by Johns Hopkins researchers looked at the role chance plays in developing cancer, and that story really got a lot of people's interest and sort of lit up the board, so to speak, when it comes to social media. But speaking of social media, this is a story I wanted to ask you about, John. A computer model that can predict social reaction to disease outbreaks and therefore, in some way, predict where disease is occurring and at what rate.
Yes.
Is that right? What's going on here? Because,
yeah,
you know, we've talked in the past with a Hopkins researcher who was looking at Twitter and outbreaks of the flu. So what do we have now? We have more on this, I guess.
Right. And so what this gets to is whenever we're talking about most of these issues, outbreaks, pandemics, especially if we're talking about new things to most people like Ebola, the question that always comes up is, what is the tenor of communication in terms of how does it, from media among different people on social media, since now we have access to all this information that is arguably less vetted? That's the whole issue with social media, is that at least in terms of general media reporting, there is a process. Now, whether or not it is reported well or not,
right,
is another issue. But when it's just one person talking to each other or anything from the internet, where it's so easy for misinformation, it's like the game that you play when you're in preschool where you have a line of kids and someone whispers something in one person's ear and then 10 persons later,
yeah,
what does that actually come up to be?
Completely garbled, right, and botched and changed, yeah.
Yeah, but since everyone engages in social media, there's been a lot of thought of, well, can we analyze this, looking at human behavior, looking at human communication through social media, to derive things about what can we learn about how people respond to hearing about different diseases. One thing that's interesting that I had mentioned to you before was that there's actually something that's been around for a few years called Google Flu View, which is this idea that in 2009, Google published a paper in the journal Science. And what they did was they figured, well, is there any way, because when people get sick, clearly, if it's flu season, are they going to Google more for influenza? Are they going to Google more for
sure,
certain terms?
Sure they are, aren't they?
And,
no.
Yeah. And so what they did was they did a study to come up with something like 45 of the top search terms that seem to actually correlate with when the CDC or the state health departments look at how many people have influenza. Do these match up? And then they made a model off of that. And so they figured out that they could predict this. But there are some potential problems with this. And so there's a lot of interesting, to pull it back to this study, there are a lot of interesting details in here. But the biggest thing that struck me was they essentially said that on social media, at least, things like back when we had the H1N1 influenza, that was less impressive to people because it was something that we know about. Whereas things like SARS back in 2004 or Ebola now, this was a new scary thing. And so the social media chatter seemed to very much overestimate for the new scary thing that people aren't used to. People were overestimating
risks, meaning transmission or risk?
Personal risk,
right,
and transmission.
So it gets
sense.
A lot more attention than it deserves.
Right.
And they have a model for figuring out whether it's getting more attention than it deserves.
Yes, exactly. Oh, and so, for instance, for the H1N1, the deal was that it seemed like in their model that it was people were underestimating the impact that it would have to them, the impact it was having in the United States, those types of things.
Another story, we can just touch on this one briefly. It's just a miserable story from Cambodia. A Cambodian village has been overwhelmed with HIV, and according to authorities, it's all because of one unlicensed doctor.
Right, and the interesting thing about that is that this was, yes, an unlicensed doctor, and the key thing was that he was reusing needles. He was reusing equipment that had been exposed to blood. He's been practicing there for several years, but there's no evidence in terms of anyone who's talked to him or even from most of the villagers. He was doing good things. It's not like he was cutting corners because he was you know, had a different agenda or there was something criminal or something like that. He really was trying in a low resource setting, it seems, to deliver good care to people. But the problem is that that's not good medical care in terms of protecting people from bloodborne pathogens like HIV. And unfortunately now, a huge spike in this village of all these people.
More than 200 people.
Yes, across three different generations of people. So like grandparents, parents, and children. And it's just, it's an awful, awful tragedy that they were talking about.
I guess we'll call him medical practitioner, I guess, not a doctor. Yem Trin, or Shrin, C-H-R-I-N. He was charged with aggravated murder, intentionally spreading HIV and practicing without a medical license. And he is in prison. A sad story from the New York Times just this week. A little village called Roka in Cambodia.
And if there's a lesson to be derived from that, it's just that there's a reason why we do these different controls that we do. There's a reason why we have to be attentive to not reusing things, being very, very safe when dealing with blood, especially in unknown situations.
And one last short bit on aspirin, taking aspirin daily. So I thought this was recommended for everyone. Actually, I'm not sure that's true. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but that's generally what I've been told over the last few years. Take an aspirin a day, it's good for you, right?
Mm-hmm. It's gonna
It's gonna prevent heart attack.
Exactly.
And we got a study saying, not so fast, maybe not every day.
Exactly. And so this is actually a very complicated issue in which it is controversial, even in terms of some of the guidelines that we have in terms of us as being primary care doctors, just regular adult primary care doctors, in terms of how we deal with patients. And it really comes down to, we know that it's worth a certain risk if somebody's had a heart attack to give you, to say, take aspirin, because it's going to be preventative of another event. But the big question comes down to this thing that we call primary prevention. It's, we're trying to give you a thing to prevent something like a heart attack from happening to you in the future. And there have been a lot of studies done, and people have created risk calculators that we can actually use online as physicians to go plug in, say, things about your medical history, your age, and it will come up and give sort of a percentage, what is your risk over the next few years of having an event like this? And if it's higher, then we could say, okay, this would be a great setting to give you aspirin. But the problem with these blood thinning medications, of course, is that if someone has, say, an ulcer, or they have a propensity for bleeding otherwise, you can have severe side effects from taking aspirin. And so it is still a very murky question of figuring out what is the risk and what is the benefit in each individual person. And this particular study was speaking to the fact that at least in the certain group of people they looked at who were felt to be at lower risk for having problems due to bleeding, they actually found that these people who were getting aspirin were having a surprising, relatively speaking, numbers of adverse events, so bleeding events, due to likely taking the aspirin than if they had not. And so it's actually a very complex question. And so the blanket statement, and some people, even health professionals, have advocated maybe everybody should take aspirin. That seems to be, this is really getting into our current, the 21st century, the idea of personalized medicine. This really comes down that it's hard to make a blanket guideline for everybody. This is something where seeing your doctor, coming up with your own personal, what is your risk based on family, based off of what your current health status is aspirin the right thing for you?
It sounds like the key piece there is what your doctor says about your risk.
Right, yes.
Don't assume that you're at risk or that this is a great preventative, generally speaking. Find out whether there's a risk, first of all.
Exactly. You have to find out what the risk is. There's a lot of evidence that goes into telling us what those risks mean. And so hopefully your physician is going to do a great job of interpreting that to help you make that decision about taking aspirin.
Dr. John Smarr is with us for the remainder of the hour. This is Midday on Health. Dan Roderick's here. Random chances role in cancer, bad luck's role in developing cancer. We'll talk about that, a Hopkins study, after this break. 410-662-8780. We have open phone lines for the remainder of the hour if you have a question for Dr. John Smarr. Welcome back to Midday. Bad luck of random mutations plays predominant role in cancer, studies show. This is a press release from Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins? Johns Hopkins Medicine. We're going to get to that in just a minute. There was a lot of talk about this, a lot of buzz, a lot of negative reaction to the study late last month or early this month. We'll get to that in a minute. Before I do, John Smarr, I want to ask you about Eugenio Cingolani, Dr. Cingolani. He had an interesting, his work has been highlighted in Discover magazine. He's used a gene to spur typical heart cells to become specialized pacemakers, according to Discover. But just tell us, you know him. He's a friend of yours. He actually was a student here.
He was a resident at Sinai Hospital actually just a few years ago. He graduated from Sinai here, and then he had already been doing some research at the time that he was with us. And then he went to do his cardiology fellowship at Cedars-Sinai out in California. And he's now faculty there and has continued his research. And so I have to say that I feel a little bit like a proud papa, because Discover magazine every year has a issue where they come out with their top 100 science stories of the last year. And he is number 34 on the list for this specific thing.
Can we read that online? I haven't read that story.
Yeah,
I assume
absolutely.
It's online.
Yeah. You can read like the first snippet for free, but then you have to be a subscriber. But you can see the first paragraph or two online. Yeah. So if you go to Discover, it's the current issue. But essentially what he is looking at is he's looking at the idea that there are lots of risks potentially associated when you implant a pacemaker in a person. And if you could do something by doing gene therapy, so if your heart cells that usually, your pacemaker cells in your heart that usually cause the electric contractions to progress, if there's a problem with those, if you could use gene therapy to actually stimulate some of your own heart cells to make a new essentially internal pacemaker, then you could save folks the challenge of putting in a pacemaker device, which has its own potential risks and troubles. And so it's very, very exciting stuff that he's working on.
The report that I mentioned about the random chance's role in cancer, or bad luck's role in the development of cancer, came out January 1st. It was the first of the year.
Yes.
And then Johns Hopkins Medicine amended their release on January 7th. Because of all the public response to this research by Christian Tomasetti and Bert Vogelstein, their research paper over at Hopkins, that I gave the title, Bad Luck of Random Mutations Plays Predominant Role in Cancer. And so we can talk about this for a minute, John. Mm-hmm. I just want to read the analogy that they presented.
Yes, absolutely, because the analogy that they did, it's very clear, and so it's worth reading out. Yes.
The question is, Hopkins put out sort of a Q&A press release, follow-up press release on this for Tomasetti and Vogelstein. Is there an analogy that can help put the results of your research in perspective? And I'll read this as quickly as possible. Getting cancer could be compared to getting into a car accident. Our results would be equivalent to showing a high correlation between length of trip and getting into an accident. Regardless of the destination, the longer the trip is, the higher the risk of an accident. The road conditions on the way to the destination could be likened to the environmental factors in cancer. Worse conditions would be associated with a higher risk of an accident. The mechanical condition of the car is a metaphor for the inherited genetic factors. The numbers of mechanical problems in the car, bad brakes, worn tires, increase the risk of an accident. Think of these mechanical problems as inherited genetic mutations. With each mechanical defect, the risk of an accident increases. Similarly, the amount of inherited genetic mutations is among the factors that contribute to cancer risk. Now, consider the length of the trip. This could be likened to the stem cell divisions and random mutations we discuss in our paper. Even with bad road conditions and driving a car in disrepair, the length of the trip plays a significant role. An extremely short trip has an accident risk close to zero. Regardless of road and car conditions, the probability of an accident occurring increases with distance traveled. Short trips have the lowest risk, while long trips are associated with the highest risk. In closing here, I'm just going to read a little bit more here. We would estimate that 2/3 of the risk of getting into an accident is attributable to the length of the trip. The rest of the risk comes from bad cars, bad roads, and other factors. In terms of cancer, we calculate that 2/3 of the variation is attributable to the random mutations that occur in stem cell divisions throughout a person's lifetime, while the remaining risk is associated with environmental factors and inherited gene mutations.
Yes. So,
well, that helps me a lot. The length of trip referring
right,
to
right.
To your lifetime and stem cells.
Yeah. And so I think it's worth to note where the controversy came from, and it was actually because a little bit of oversimplification of what they actually did and what the results were. Because when this study was actually published, which I believe it was published on January the 2nd, and as you said before, the first press release was on the 1st, it was reported and people talked about, oh, you're saying 2/3 of cancer is just caused by bad luck. And that's actually not what they're saying. So when you look at what they did is came up with a statistical model to try to predict people's cancer risk, as was talked about in there. And what they found was that when you break it down for different types of cancer, you can see that there are very clearly cancers that are very much influenced by genetics. So, for instance, breast cancer and other cancers in females. There's this BRCA gene that's something that we do genetic testing for. It's not a routine thing if there's a risk to figure out whether or not, let's say, if your mother gets breast cancer at a certain age, to try to figure out, should I get tested for this to see if I have this? Am I going to be at risk? Should I do something about it? Then you've got cancers that clearly have a very strong environmental factor. So lung cancer with cigarette smoking. And so it plays very clearly a high role is from the environmental exposure. But when they look at all cancers, and the problem is that this is you're trying to make a general statement about all cancers, which is trying to make a general statement, say, about all food. There's so much variation in things that when you look at all cancers, that about 2/3 of the cancers that people get based on this statistical model is due to variations in when cancer cells arise. Essentially, you're starting out with stem cells, which are the cells that split and divide and to make new cells. And in many parts of our body, we need that. We need to replenish new cells. And it's because during that splitting and dividing process, essentially, something goes wrong. Something's mistranslated. That's what a mutation is.
Random spontaneous glitches. How about that?
I love that.
Is that how you put it?
So you have random spontaneous glitches. And then when you have a glitch, then you could produce a cell that's not a healthy cell, but it's one that's going to keep growing and growing without any of the necessary controls to rein it in, which is typically what cancer is. And so I think one of the big problems is that they made this big blanket statement. But I think that anyone who has a question about this should go and read the rest of this press release, because it actually has some good quotes at the bottom. And to me, some of the better quotes are actually from the original one all the way at the bottom on the 1st, because they point out the fact that, you know, there are some people, and I think most of us have known someone like this in our lives, who smoked their entire life and they lived to be a ripe old age and they had no evidence of cancer. And in the past, and I think the quote that they made, in the past we would say that it was due to sort of good genes. And at the end of the day, what they're saying is that it was good luck in that for them, when these stem cells were dividing, they didn't ever mutate. And so it was more of a good chance. Whereas in colon cancer, the stem cells that make more good, healthy colon cells, it's very, very active that you have to make lots more cells in your colon compared to, say, other parts of your bowels. So statistically, whether or not you are exposed to diet or other things that we've implicated in the Western diet, for instance, that increase our risk for colon cancer, in general, for everybody, there's probably a higher probability of getting colon cancer than getting other types of cancer, and that there is an element of luck in that. And so I just hope I'm being clear, because the problem is it makes far more sense when you look at the details when they talk about the different types of cancer, but the blanket statement is very confusing, and especially when you simplify it to the fact that they were just saying that 2/3 of cancers are random. That's actually not what they were saying.
Right. And they're not excusing all these other environmental factors that people point to and are concerned about that are less clear than smoking.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Chemicals, for instance, processed food, all of that stuff. We were talking about this study by Christian Tomasetti and Bert Vogelstein at Johns Hopkins University. You can read that press release I referred to. If you go to the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, we posted it on there. We'll tweet it out. And by the way, their study was underwritten by nonprofit cancer foundations and grants from NIH, the National Institutes of Health.
Yes.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
This is a really interesting program. There's lots of things to talk about. Every time John Smarr joins us, he joins us once a month for Midday on Health. John Smarr from Sinai Hospital. Hope you enjoyed that hour of Midday. Thank you again, John.
Thank you, Dan.
We'll take a break here for lunch, and then the second hour of Midday coming right along. We hope you'll stay tuned for that after the news from NPR.